something in the nest.
Oh, you might see something. I'm trying. That's what I'm trying to help you to see.
Thank you for trying.
Don't you see? You're making it all up in your mind. You're imagining that you're caught. You're imagining that you need to let go. You're imagining all of this.
That was Ajishanti, an American spiritual teacher based in Santa Cruz, California. If you're interested in hearing more of Ajishanti, there's lots of his talks on YouTube.
And the future never comes. What? And the future never comes. What comes is always here now. And because of your habit of worrying about the future, we will base that movement also for worry. And because of your habit of worrying about the future, we will base that movement also for worry. One now, another now, wherever you are, it will be here and now.
And that's it for this Magical Mystery Tour. Thank you so much for listening. If you missed any of the show or would like to hear it again, you can find this and all Magical Mystery Tour shows at soundcloud.com/WGDR. That's soundcloud.com/WGDR. And until next time, take good care of yourselves and each other.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Welcome to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience produced at a different location every week. I'm Mark Hurst, the host of Tectonic, a production of WFMU in Jersey City, New Jersey. Today on Sprouts, we'll hear my interview with Adam Becker, author of the book More Everything Forever, AI Overlords, Space Empires, and Silicon Valley's Crusade to Control the Fate of Humanity. Adam, thanks for being with me today. I wanted to start with a question about you, since you're a somewhat unexpected guide to these technology topics, because you're not from the tech industry. You actually have a PhD in astrophysics, is that right?
Yeah, as you said, I have a PhD in astrophysics. Specifically, my thesis was in early universe cosmology, trying to understand what was happening around the Big Bang and how we could get a better sense of what was happening. By the time I finished my PhD, I was pretty sure that I didn't want to stay in academia for a variety of reasons, including the fact that the job market's, you know, not that great. And also, I have broad interests, and I had been thinking for quite some time that science journalism and science communication were areas that seemed like a good fit for me and stuff that I was interested in. And so I moved out to the Bay. For a while, I was sort of doing the things that you would sort of expect someone with that resume to do, right? You know, writing about space and physics. And by that point, I'd been living out here in the Bay for quite some time, almost a decade, and thought, you know, I have been seeing a lot of crap coming from the tech industry and a lot of really unrealistic ideas about what the future will be like that they are peddling to us, that people take very, very seriously, even though there's no scientific basis for those ideas, because there is this unspoken assumption that the leaders of the tech industry must know what they're talking about when it comes to science because they are the leaders of the tech industry. And that's just not true. The leaders of the tech industry don't really understand science particularly well, in a lot of ways understand it worse than most people. And so that led me to this book.
In this book, you're writing about several overlapping schools of thought that are present or even dominant in Silicon Valley. You cover effective altruism, also known as EA, effective accelerationism,
which sometimes annoyingly is written as a lowercase e/acc. You cover long-termism, rationalism, one of my favorite words in the book, singularitarianism.
Yeah.
People who believe in the singularity that Ray Kurzweil and others have been predicting for a while. Together, these isms, these schools of thought, appear to be creating a kind of a new religion.
Yeah.
Centered on, let's be clear, the wealth and power of the tech billionaires.
Yeah.
Multiple times in the book, you talk explicitly about the religious aspect of this venture. And you even have a phrase for it that I like a lot. You call it the ideology of technological salvation.
As I define it in the book, the ideology of technological salvation, it's got three main components that sort of merge to form this religious or pseudo-religious set of beliefs or worldview. The first is the idea that all problems can be reduced to problems of technology in general, and computer science in particular, or computer programming. And I don't just mean, you know, problems that we would expect to be able to solve with technology, like creating a better phone messaging app, or even a problem that might be amenable to solving with better technology, like a self-driving car. I mean any problem, like world peace or immortality or what have you. The second is this idea that there will be perpetual growth, which leads to perpetual profitability. And so you can have just a perpetuation of the Silicon Valley business model forever.
And you do mean forever.
I mean forever. To the end of the universe and beyond.
And beyond.
And beyond. Yeah. Mark Andreessen, a tech venture capitalist, is very, very explicit about this. But these then point to the third thing, which is the promise of transcendence of all possible limits through the promise of technological solutions and perpetual growth. You can transcend all, you know, financial limits. You can transcend all legal limits or moral limits. You can transcend not just conventional morality, but your own biology. And you can ultimately transcend the laws of physics.
All right. So we have solutionism, that is, we can solve any problem with tech. And we have this belief in perpetual growth forever and ever. And we have this faith in transcendence, transcending all limits.
Yeah.
I mean, that's very churchy language. You know, we're talking about eternity and transcendence and faith. I want to get into an example, because here we are talking kind of on an abstract level about the religiosity of these tech billionaires and their acolytes. But I want to jump to this chapter called The Ethicist at the End of the Universe. It's talking about Toby Ord and some other guys at Oxford who are interested in solving the what they see as the existential risks that we face here on Earth, primarily runaway AI.
Yeah.
So the idea with long-termism, this is the example I want to get to, is the idea that our future, this is the techies talking, that our future is in the stars. We are going to get off of this planet, we're going to colonize other star systems in the galaxy, and there's not going to be billions of humans. There will be trillions and trillions of humans in the future. And so we have to build now for that bright, shining future.
Yeah, I mean, another one of these effective altruists, like one of the main leaders, Will McCaskill, he said that there's a moral case for space settlement.
There's some strange mathematics also at work in this so-called morality, which is, if we're going to, and here we're going to have to talk about exponents. So, if, you know, a million is 10 to the 6, a billion is 10 to the 9, a trillion is 10 to the 12. So that exponent over 10 gets bigger and bigger. So they're talking about humans in the future numbering 10 to the 50 or something. And talk me through, Adam, just a very basic explanation of how the equation works when we're looking on the order of 10 billion humans today, and they're talking about investing in a future of potentially 10 to the 50 humans. How does that change the dynamic for what they say we should do today?
So we don't just need to talk about exponents to explain that. There's another idea that we have to talk about, which is expected value. Expected value is one of these things that you see a lot if you are, say, learning how to play a game of chance like poker or craps or something like that. So let's say that we're playing a very, very simple game where I flip a coin, and if it comes up heads, I'm going to give you a dollar. But if it comes up tails, you're going to give me a dollar. So what's the expected value in that situation for you is how much you're going to earn or lose multiplied by the probability of it happening. And then you add all of those up. So you've got a 50% chance of gaining a dollar. So that's, you know, 0.5 times 1, so 1/2. But you've also got a 50% chance of losing a dollar. So that's minus 1 times 1/2. And so you end up with 1/2 plus negative 1/2, which is 0. And so the expected value of playing this game over and over and over again is 0. You know, in all likelihood, you and I will just end up with the same amount of money that we started with. But if instead we made it so that if I flip heads, you get a dollar from me, but if it comes up tails, you have to pay me 50 cents, then suddenly the game looks a lot better for you, because then the expected value of the game is 25 cents each time we play. And so that means that you should play, because on average, you're going to get a quarter from me each time we play. This works great for evaluating games of chance. The problem is that the effective altruists like to use this to evaluate the ethical implications of various situations. And so if you have this enormous number of humans that you think is going to live in the future because you think that we're going to colonize the galaxy, then you have this, you know, like this enormous number, right? You have like 10 to the 50 humans, which is what? That's like a trillion, 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 like 100 trillion, 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 trillion. Yeah, that's yes. 10 to the 50.
That's right.
Which is crazy. But the thing is, that's so much larger than the number of humans that are alive today, that if you can do something that will, you know, make the lives of all of those humans, all of those 10 to the 50 humans in the future better, even if there's only like a 1 in a billion chance that that future is going to come to pass, this expected value calculation tells you, well, yeah, but the number that you end up with is still so huge that you should absolutely take the chance to help all of those possible future humans over all of the humans that are definitely alive right now. And this leads to really bad conclusions like that. And to me, seems like a good argument that this is a bad way of doing ethics.
So you quote this long-termist named Nick Beckstead, who wrote a memorable passage in his PhD thesis from 2013, which has become an important document for the long-termists, you say.
Yes.
Here's what Beckstead wrote, quote, "Saving lives in poor countries may have significantly smaller ripple effects than saving and improving lives in rich countries. Why? Richer countries have substantially more innovation, and their workers are much more economically productive." And then he adds, "Saving a life in a rich country is substantially more important than saving a life in a poor country, other things being equal." And this is just part of that quantitative morality that you were just talking about, that as you write later in that same chapter, funding AI safety research is trillions of times more cost-effective, say the long-termists, than preventing the spread of malaria. Saving a billion people today isn't as good as a minuscule chance of saving 10 to the 50 people who might exist someday. So this is a pattern, not just in long-termism, but throughout the book, this came up again and again, that the tech billionaires and all of these guys with this ideology are ignoring the problems that we have in the world today and ignoring the people in need today in favor of their own schemes that they believe they have a moral duty to fund, which, as you later write, have no chance of coming to pass anyway. But it's all because of this crazy calculus.
Yeah. There is this desire to come up with a future that is mathematically provably good. And as a big fan of math and as a big fan of things that are good, that's not how either of those things work, right? Like, you know, one of the things that they need to believe in order for any of this to work out is that it's possible to quantify and compare different amounts of goodness in different, you know, in every different possible situation in the world, like at least in principle, if not in practice. And that's just not how the world works. There's lots of good reasons to think that that is in principle impossible.
Well, I think people in major religions would probably disagree with the premise that it's better to serve the rich than the poor. I mean, that just flies in the face of the most basic morals and ethics that have been around for thousands of years.
Yeah, I mean, that part of Beckstead's thesis is really jaw-droppingly awful.
You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of global interest. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm the host of Tectonic, a production of WFMU in Jersey City, New Jersey. We're speaking today with Adam Becker about his book, More Everything Forever, AI Overlords, Space Empires, and Silicon Valley's Crusade to Control the Fate of Humanity.
There was another outcome of this calculus that you write later in this chapter. You're saying that the long-termists have drawn another conclusion here. And this has to do with what you were just talking about, quantifying the good, or in this case, quantifying people's happiness and life, as though there is a unit called the happy, you know, like today I had 10 happies because I ate ice cream or something. And what they're saying is that at the number of humans that they're building towards, let's just use 10 to the 50, 100 trillion, 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 even if the people in the future are just barely hanging on to a will to live. I mean, they have the most miserable existence ever.
Yeah.
That means like they're getting one happy a day, which is just barely enough to continue wanting to exist.
Yeah.
That is far, the long-termists say, that is far superior than a utopia on Earth today where all 8 billion or so people have the absolute best life.
Yeah.
Food, shelter, community, and just amazing lives. So talk to me about this, where a galaxy full of incredibly miserable people is somehow considered superior to building the best possible Earth that we can have today.
I mean, this is the natural conclusion that you come to if you say that these sorts of things have to be quantified and measured, and that your approach to ethics is just purely mathematical in this way. Like, this conclusion that you were just describing is this famous thought experiment in ethics called the repugnant conclusion. This idea that, you know, an enormous number of people who are mostly miserable and just barely happy enough to keep on living is better than a genuinely fulfilled and happy world with way fewer people in it. Most philosophers believe that the repugnant conclusion has to be false, and I agree with them because that just seems to be true, right? Like, I think that a world of soul-crushing poverty for untold trillions of people is a worse future than one where there's a smaller number of people who are all very, very happy. I also think that, you know, these ideas of cosmic expansion and galactic colonialism that are implied in all of this are just deeply abhorrent for their own reasons. But that's not how the long-termists see it. They think that we have to do this. And the bad news for them and the good news for the rest of us is not only do we not have to do it, their philosophy is bad, but we can't do it. The actual practical logistics of colonizing space are somewhere between highly, highly improbable and genuinely impossible.
Okay, so let's talk about that. And I'm glad that you brought up those two questions, because these are the two underlying questions throughout your response to these guys. Number one, can it happen? And number two, even if it could, should it happen?
Yeah.
And I think we just explored number two there.
Yeah.
And let's go to this first question. Can it happen? So Elon Musk, among others, loves to tell us how we're going to be living on Mars. He's techno king of Mars. He's going to terraform Mars by dropping nuclear bombs on the planet. And I've seen this stuff for years, and I've always felt like, I know this is complete BS, but I don't have a PhD in astrophysics to write a book to solidly disprove what he's saying. So talk to us just about Mars.
Yeah.
How hard is it for humans to make a livable environment on Mars?
It's essentially impossible. It's not happening. And this is just because Mars is an absolutely terrible place. One of the things that I'm really struck by when I talk with people about this, before I, you know, get into exactly why Mars is so awful, but one of the things I'm really struck by is the number of people who, when I tell them that, they say, but, you know, I really want to go anyway, and, like, wouldn't it be cool? And, you know, I think there are a lot of people who would really want to, like, move to Mars and live their lives there. And, like, I think that those people who you're talking about do exist. And that they do not understand what Mars is like. Because if you ask those people, how would you feel about moving to the middle of the Sahara or the Gobi Desert, or moving to Antarctica in the polar night, or living your entire life and raising a family at the top of Mount Everest? All of those people would say no, or almost all. And the thing is, all of those places are so much nicer and so much easier to live in than anywhere on Mars ever. And this is because Mars is radically inhospitable. The radiation levels are too high, the gravity is too low, there's no air, and the dirt is made of poison. And that's not even all of the problems.
But other than that, Adam...
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Other than that, you know, Musk says that he wants to put 1 million people there by 2050 and that it needs to be a self-sufficient colony to act as a backup for humanity. And so they need to be able to survive even if the rockets from Earth stop coming. And that's in case of a disaster here on Earth, like, you know, he often mentions an asteroid strike. First of all, Mars gets hit by more asteroids than Earth does. Second, there was a huge asteroid strike here 66 million years ago. It killed off all of the dinosaurs except for the birds, right? The really famous one. That is the single worst day in the history of complex life here on Earth. That day, that asteroid hit, there was, you know, massive tidal waves all around the Earth, a crater so deep it almost punched all the way through the Earth's crust, enormous amounts of material ejected out into space. There's probably fragments of dinosaur bone on the moon now from that impact. And when all of that stuff, you know, a bunch of that material then re-entered the atmosphere, burned up and caused a pulse of heat that cooked animals at the surface, created worldwide forest fires, and then a plume of fine material in the atmosphere cut off almost all sunlight to the surface for 10 years and cut the bottom out of the food chain. And ultimately, something like 75 or 80% of all species went extinct, and 99.9% of all individual living organisms died. Really, really awful stuff. That was a better time for life on Earth. That was a better time and place to be than the surface of Mars at any point in its history. Like, if you gave me a choice between being on Earth that day the asteroid hit or being on Mars, I would choose Earth because I would probably die on Earth, but I'd definitely die on Mars. Because if you go to Mars without a spacesuit, the air pressure is so low that you will asphyxiate while the saliva boils off your tongue. And if you build a pressure dome on the surface, you would still need to bring in air from somewhere or, you know, try to produce it there on the surface, which would involve bringing in materials that you would then consume from, you know, off the planet. And you'd still get a lot of cancer, because there's all that radiation at the surface. So what you really need to do is dig tunnels underground to protect yourself from the radiation, but then you need to deal with the fact that the dirt is poisonous and everywhere. Musk wants to terraform Mars. His plans for doing that don't work. There are no plans to terraform Mars that work. because Mars is just lacking the materials that it would need, like enough water and air. And even if you somehow solve every single one of those problems and you put 1 million people on Mars, that's not enough people to be self-sufficient, because the best economic estimates for how many people you would need to run a self-sustaining, independent, high-tech society is somewhere around 500 million to 1 billion people. And so what that means is, if Earth did get hit by an asteroid, everyone on Mars would die because the rockets would stop coming. Whereas, you know, only most of the people on Earth would die. So Earth would still be a better option. There is nothing that we could possibly do to this planet that would make it a worse option than Mars.
Yeah. And then, so Musk says, well, we're going to terraform it. And here's where we get to a really key point, which is picking up on a pattern that we mentioned a little bit earlier. You write that terraforming Mars is unequivocally more difficult than solving global warming on Earth.
Yeah.
So here we see Musk looking at the challenges that we're facing here on Earth. One of the primary challenges being the climate crisis, global warming, whatever you want to call it. And he says, don't worry about the challenge here on Earth. We're going to go to Mars and we're going to terraform it. Once again, you have a tech billionaire who, rather than engaging with the problems that we all need to work on, and to be honest, he has contributed to in building his fortune, rather than addressing those problems that he's complicit in, he defers all of it, shirks all of his responsibility, and comes up with a fantasy that involves space.
Yep, that's about the size of it. I mean, the problems that we face here on Earth right now are just much easier to deal with than the problems that you would have to solve if you want to try to make a real go at doing the things that Musk wants to do. And the justifications for solving the problems here on Earth are much stronger than the justifications for trying to do any of the stuff that Musk wants to do. The difference, I think, is twofold. First of all, it's what you just said, which is, you know, Musk and the other tech billionaires bear an enormous amount of the responsibility for causing and not solving these problems. But also, and I think that this is part of why the sort of ploy that Musk has engaged in of look over at Mars has worked in the public eye so well for so long, it's more fun to talk about colonizing Mars than it is to talk about solving climate change, right? Because dealing with the climate crisis, dealing with global warming, mostly involves doing very boring, unsexy stuff. We know what we need to do. We just haven't done it, because there have been a lot of vested, you know, moneyed interests that have tried to prevent the rest of us from actually addressing the problem, and tried to, and so far successfully, divided us and gotten a lot of people to work against their own best interests. Mars, on the other hand, Mars is fun, right? That sounds like fun. Space is fun. It's the final frontier. It's everything that science fiction promised us. What could be more fun than going to space? And the idea that, you know, let's get a fresh start and go somewhere else and that will solve all of our problems is a tempting way of running away from a big, scary, boring problem. And it's also, of course, something that has a long history in the American psyche, the idea of the frontier as the solution to all of our problems. It's all right in there. But the point I was just going to make about Mars is just that, like, even if you have 100 people living there, it's going to be a company town, and it's all going to be in the hands of SpaceX. And these people, if they don't pay their SpaceX bill, they're not going to have oxygen to breathe. I don't feel like paying an oxygen bill. I like that we have air for free.
Well, one thing we can take away from this book is that we're never going to Mars. And for that matter, we're never going to upload our minds to a galactic computer either, or become immortal. And the singularity is never going to happen either. All things that you might have sensed already, but the reasons why are so clearly laid out here. The book is called More Everything Forever: AI Overlords, Space Empires, and Silicon Valley's Crusade to Control the Fate of Humanity. Thanks again to Adam for being on the show.
And that's it for Sprouts. You have been listening to my interview with Adam Becker. Production assistance came from Stephanie Schubert from Pacifica Affiliate Network. The Sprouts theme song is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the globe. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase globally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Mark Hurst, and you can find me at tectonic.fm. That's tectonic.fm. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Hey, stuck in a slump? Sometimes you gotta shake it out. There's a time for everything. And right now, it's time to dance. Join us for the Digital Rhythm Revolution. Every fifth Sunday from 7 to 8 p.m., we provide dance classics, new bops, dub, breakbeats, oddities, the electronica spectrum from hardcore to downtempo. Join us for the Digital Rhythm Revolution on 90.7 FM KBOO Portland. Or join us online or stream anytime at kboo.fm.